We're a little short of a quorum, but we're going to get started anyway. The rest will join us as soon as they can, I'm sure, but we have a lot to cover and only a limited amount of time. Mr. Cass, we appreciate you continuing the presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barry Cast, Assistant Director for Health Services, Department of Human Services. And as you know, we made most of the way through public health yesterday, but we still have two sections to discuss. And Mr. Britton has assembled an agenda for today, including the Office of Family Health and the Public Health Laboratories, before we move on to mental health and addictions. I'm going to change the order that's in the agenda here and ask Dr. Skeels from the Public Health Laboratory to join me because he has an appointment back in Portland. But Dr. Skeels, as I think I mentioned yesterday, was at one time the administrator of the Oregon Health Division and has a very broad knowledge, many years of experience with public health.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Skeels. I'm, as Barry said, the administrator of the Office of the State Public Health Laboratory. Our office does not have any key performance measures assigned to it, so I won't have any of those to present to you. But what I'd like to do, with your permission, is just give you a very brief overview of what we do, why we do it, and highlight the one graph that's shown up here. We exist to serve as the laboratory for Oregon's public health system, for state activities and local health departments. We do a very wide range of communicable disease testing, everything from HIV to hepatitis and E. coli, salmonella. Some of the kinds of outbreaks that Mel Cohn talked about yesterday at the Lane County Fair and the almonds and so forth are examples of the kind of thing that we do to support other people's public health activities. Most of those samples for infectious diseases come from local health department clinics for patients that are seen there. We also provide unique testing for unusual diseases like rabies or botulism or West Nile virus, or things that nobody else in the state does but which have significant public health impact and somebody needs to provide. So we do those kinds of tests as well. We also provide rapid response when there's a public health emergency. And in recent years, we've been really tooling up in the area of bioterrorism for things like anthrax and plague and tularemia and so on and so forth. And we do a little bit of environmental testing for water and food. In addition, actually our largest volume item is screening newborn babies for genetic disorders of body chemistry. And we test every baby in five states, Oregon, Alaska, Idaho, Nevada, and Hawaii, by a little bit of dried blood that's collected from the baby at birth and is sent to us. And we test each baby for 26 different disorders. This is something that we've been doing since 1962, when Oregon became the first state to mandate statewide screening for these disorders. And we've had a regional program since the 1970s. And our regional program is really considered a model for the nation. A lot of other states would like to emulate what we do. As you can see up here on this graph, in the 2001 legislative session, the legislature authorized us to increase our fees so that we could upgrade our technology and expand our panel of services. And Senator Bates was intimately involved in that process and supported and encouraged us throughout, for which we're very grateful. Since being able to do that, we've been able to significantly increase the number of tests per baby, the number of disorders that we screen for, with almost no increase in staff, partly because of automation and improved technologies and being able to multiplex panel a lot of different tests. And so what you see here is really a credit to our having been given the authority to do that. And it's really working. We found 19 or 20 babies with disorders that would not have been detected had we not been doing this expanded panel of screening. Some of those babies certainly would have died, because these disorders lead to disability and sometimes death. So this is a big accomplishment for Oregon, and we're very proud of it. Just to give you a quick example of the kind of performance standards against which we compare or measure ourselves, we're a high-volume lab. We get about 375,000 samples a year, and we do over 6 million tests on those samples. And as a result, we have to have a comprehensive quality assurance system in place. We have to monitor our processes, including our tests, the quality of the information that we produce. We have ourselves challenged with blind unknown samples that are sent to us from national organizations to test us and make sure that we are doing things correctly. We have an event reporting system so that if there's any kind of a problem, it comes to management attention and we deal with it directly. And we have systems to maintain the security and the integrity of all of our information. Our customer satisfaction, our turnaround time, all of those things are measured. And we have external oversight from the College of American Pathologists, which is the largest accrediting organization for medical labs in the country. It's the same organization that accredits most large independent and many hospital laboratories as well. So we hold ourselves to the same standards as them. And in addition to all of the testing activity that we do, we also regulate Oregon's 2,000 medical laboratories. We inspect them for state under state law and under federal CLIA requirements as well, and we offer accreditation for environmental laboratories. With that, I think I'll just stop, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Questions?
I don't really have any questions. I just want to thank you, Mike, for coming here again. And when you put this program together, you said you'd do this, and you've done it. And I'm just incredibly proud of what Oregon does for the other states around us. I think this is a program, if I remember correctly, too, that pretty well is self-supporting from fees that you gather from other states. And it's sort of amazing that little Oregon takes care of all these other four or five states around us and does such an exemplary job. What a lot of people may not understand and is that these people, these babies you're finding that have these abnormalities of inborn metabolism, many of them would go on and live, but they'd be terribly retarded, mentally retarded and disabled. And the things they find, like PKU and other problems, are treatable if you catch them at birth. And these children go on to have normal lives as a result of this testing. So every time you find one of these children, you've had a tremendous change in that child's life, that family's life. And frankly, and then you kind of crash the thing, the cost to that state is huge as far as saving that child. So it's humanitarian, and financially it makes sense. I'm just very proud of what you do there at that lab. And I've been to your lab, amazed how small it is, how antiquated the building is, but you get the job done. And it's a real credit to Oregon and to your organization for what you're doing. I wish the whole state ran this way. I wouldn't have any, you wouldn't even need me. I'd be home in Medford today, okay? Great job.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, thank you very much. I'll just add that a study has been done of the cost effectiveness of newborn metabolic screening, and it saves somewhere between $3 and $4 for every dollar that's spent. And you are correct, this is entirely a fee-supported program for Oregon. So thank you very much.
Great job.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, Dr. Bates, Senator Bates has mentioned the conditions of the lab, and in the last legislative session, arrangements were made to move the lab to a new site, and maybe Mike can give us just a brief synopsis of what's going to happen there over the next year and a half.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the Department of Administrative Services Facilities Division has purchased a building which is going to be retrofitted as a laboratory for both our lab and the Department of Environmental Quality Laboratory. We're currently located on the Portland State University campus downtown in Portland, and we're going to be moving somewhere in late 2006 to Hillsboro, which is the site of the new lab. And right now we're in the early design phase. DAS has awarded a contract to IDC Architects, and they're doing space programming to determine how much space we need. And that design phase should be finished by about September or October, and then the construction documents will go out and the bids will come in. And we will be addressing this later during, I assume, phases 2 and 3 of this budget process, but that is an early heads up.
Do you do any genetic testing, or is it strictly blood?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
Are you doing any genetic testing?
Mr. Chairman, we don't do testing for DNA sequences in humans in that sense of genetic testing. We're actually looking now for the biochemical evidence of an underlying genetic disorder, but we don't do, for example, studies of people's chromosomes to see if they have Down syndrome or other genetic anomalies like that. No.
Okay. Thank you for all that you're doing.
The last segment on about public health concerns our Office of Family Health, where our programs for maternal and child health are located. And Lorraine Duncan joins us today for a period in late 2004. She was the acting administrator of this office. We've hired a new administrator, Catherine Bradley. Dr. Bradley is a came to us from the Oregon Health and Science University, but has only recently started and is unable to be with us this week. So I'm very pleased that Lorraine has been able to join us, and she has for a long time been the head of our immunization program.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Human Services and acting for Catherine Bradley, who is the administrator currently. I'd like to start out by just giving you a brief overview. I know Barry gave you a list of the programs that we included, but just as a reference, the Office of Family Health includes immunization, WIC, family planning, oral health, perinatal care, and school-based health clinics, and oral health. I'm going to highlight a couple of the areas that we've done a lot of work on in the last couple of years to share some examples about how public health works in the Office of Family Health. The first one is in reference to school-based health clinics. And we currently have 42 existing school-based health clinics. One new one, well, one that was open previously plans to reopen in Yamhill County. And then we have given planning grants to three additional ones. There's also funds in the governor's budget for an addition of five additional sites, so we're really excited about that. And we have a representative here from school-based health clinics in case you have some additional questions that you might would like to ask her. The next area I'd like to highlight is in regard to the statewide immunization registry. It's called ALERT. That is not an acronym, it's just that's the name. It's called ALERT. And the purpose of ALERT is to gather the information for all immunizations given in the state of Oregon for those up to 18 years of age. We have currently about 86% of all the private physicians reporting to the statewide registry, and all public clinics are currently participating. One of the things that we do this time every year is what we call the annual review and exclusion cycle, which means all schools and daycare centers look at their immunization records, find children that are in noncompliance, and then send those records to the county health departments. The health departments then write exclusion orders to families where children are not in compliance. That number ranges anywhere from 30,000 to 50,000, a lot of exclusion orders. When the order goes out, which is basically a letter to the parent saying that you need to comply by 2 weeks from the date that the letter goes out, if that doesn't happen, then the children are excluded. And I think most of you know that exclusion day this year is tomorrow on February 16th. But one of the things ALERT does to help that is schools and daycare centers are considered authorized users, so they can go look up the child's record in the computer, and many times that puts the child into compliance. Many times the kids have the immunizations, but the documentation doesn't get to the school. So ALERT's been a big help in doing that, and schools and daycare centers have been extremely happy with having access to that registry. Another area where we spent a lot of time and effort this last year was in regard to the flu shortage. Normally, most of the flu vaccine in the state of Oregon is delivered in the private sector, and the Department of Human Services does not play a big role in that campaign. This year was quite a bit different. When it was announced that only half the vaccine would be available, we have legislation in Oregon that allows us to issue a prioritization plan. So a prioritization plan was issued for high-risk folks to be the first ones to get their flu shots. Because this was considered an emergency situation in Oregon, it was operated through emergency preparedness, through the bioterrorism program. So we went into basically what was called incident command. So instead of reporting to our normal supervisors, we had the state health officer provide the incident command leadership, and then we reported to him. It worked very well. We had lots of help from our state health officer, from our state epidemiologist. Their offices were incredible. The bioterrorism program had a lot of capabilities that we didn't have in immunization, so by partnering, we were able to take advantage of some of those things. One of them was surge capacities for doing like a hotline or a large number of calls. They helped us put in phones. They did it within 6 hours, and we had 12 phone lines dropped in. We did a hotline for 3.5 months. We took 36,000 phone calls. We were able to answer 24,000 of those calls with about a one-minute delay where people would have to listen to a recording until they actually got an operator included. So The flu vaccine this year was very difficult. We're hoping that we don't have to do that again, although flu vaccine has been a problem for the last 2 or 3 years, and we're hoping that that'll get cleared up in the future. But it seems like we've been under the gun with some kind of a vaccine shortage for what seems to be a long time. I would like to talk about the key performance measures for the Office of Family Health.
Senator Bates.
I wonder if you'd comment for a moment, thank you, Mr. Chair, about why we have a flu vaccine shortage in this country. Most of the vaccines, or some of it, or a great deal of it, is made overseas. I think there might be a medical liability reason for that. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
The Center for Disease Control has been working to try to encourage more vaccine manufacturers to get into the business of making vaccines, but that's a very difficult process in that there's not a lot of profit margin for some of the vaccines, and the liability issues have become very intense. So I think that there's going to be a lot of effort to continue to increase the manufacturers and to have the manufacture done here in the United States. The problem with the flu vaccine this year, it was made in England, and they had some early warning about the contamination, but they kept saying, it's all right, don't worry about it, it's taken care of. And then, like a week and a half later, they said, it's no good, we can't use it. So it was quite a shock.
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand this is a problem that's bigger than Oregon, but I am concerned that we are dependent on another country to make flu vaccine for this country when we used to make it ourselves. And I'm concerned that some of the things driving that are our medical liability system and the poor reimbursement for companies making the vaccine. And that's sort of the root problem. And what we do at this level is we try to manage that problem with the lack of vaccine, because I think it's going to recur and keep reoccurring until we talk about the real problem of why we haven't gotten the vaccine out there.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think that the vaccine manufacturers that do operate here in the United States, some of them make, for example, flu vaccine, but they haven't sold it here in the United States. So I think that will be the emphasis in the next year or so, is to get those folks to get it approved through FDA and to actually use it here in the United States.
Just one follow-up question, kind of in line with what Senator Bates is asking. Does your department keep track of adverse reactions to the vaccines?
There's a national reporting system for adverse reactions, and all adverse reactions that occur with public purchase vaccines through the Department of Human Services have to be reported through the Department of Human Services. Private providers report directly to a company that is contracted from the Center for Disease Control, and they then use that information and update constantly the benefit risk information about immunization, so that anytime you go in to get an immunization, there's what they call a vaccine information statement, and that statement says this is the benefit and this is the risk of having this immunization.
Representative Pinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick comment in relationship to Senator Bates' remarks. It seems to me an irony that if we look at the potential for both human suffering and fatalities in the country of flu vaccine shortage or incident could create a lot more deaths than probably anything connected with bioterrorism. And yet our emphasis is always on the potential incidents of terrorism but literally, we could have thousands of deaths at any time because of lack of inoculations. The other one that I'm starting very concerned with too is the avian flu potentials. That anyway, I guess I'm saying public health and public health incidents to me seem the prime thing that. One of the prime services the government should provide, and it's probably one of the most absolutely important things we do, and the potential for epidemics and pan-epidemics and stuff are so great in a rapidly shrinking world that we have to hone the delivery of those services just as precisely as we can, or we could get in big trouble real quick. And in over the last 20 or 30 years we have. I mean, the AIDS epidemic is certainly a classic example of that, of something that occurred, got out of control when we could very well have prevented a lot of the problems that epidemic had created and are still creating. Anyway, end of editorial.
Mr. Chairman, just one, I hate to interrupt Lorraine's presentation, but there is a lesson here, and that was that after the 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, we had a significant boost in funding for bioterrorism and public health preparedness, and the central concept there was dual use. That is, we're preparing for any hazard and using the main channels that are available to us, so that when this vaccine shortage occurred, as Lorraine pointed out, it was our health alert network and our risk communication and our methodologies that were prepared with those federal funds that enabled us to manage this in an orderly way, in contrast to what you may have seen on television about chaos in other states. And it was really a remarkable, the plan led to a great deal of cooperation and rational planning. And, of course, in the final analysis, there was enough vaccine for the demand that was mm-hmm. was out there. But the point that you're making is exactly right. Now, there is a great deal of concern about a flu pandemic. There were several in the 20th century, some of which claimed millions of lives. And one of the bright spots in an otherwise very challenging federal budget for 06 is the addition of about $120 million at the federal level to anticipate a pandemic and begin correcting this problem, which is, I think, as Senator Bates pointed, a real and present problem.
It kind of brings up something I'd like to get clarified. When we're talking about the flu vaccine, how many different types of flu does it vaccinate against?
Mr. Chair and committee members, normally each year they pick three strains, and they do that usually in the spring about this time of the year. They look at what strains have been circulating previously around the globe, and those are the ones that they pick. Normally A and B are the types that we see more often here in Oregon.
And how many strains of flu are there that generally infect the population?
Normally no more than three or four. Sometimes the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices has a struggle trying to figure out which three strains are going to be able to put into the vaccine, but normally three works out pretty well.
All right, so essentially we're vaccinating against the primary strains of flu, but there's other strains of flu that people still get, and so it's not like if you take this, you're fully protected, and if you don't, you're fully vulnerable.
That's true, Mr. Chair. When the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices picks the strains, they do the best that they can. But as the flu season evolves, sometimes it's not at the exact match, and that makes it a little bit more difficult. In regard to your comments about the pandemic, the current bioterrorism includes a section about pandemic. And so this is really our flu vaccine shortage this year was really the perfect trial run for a pandemic, and hopefully we'll never have to have a real one, but it was a perfect exercise because it allowed us to work with our partners, the many partners that we have, the OMA, the Pediatric Society, Family Practice. We came together with them to figure out do we need to reduce who's going to get this vaccine, prioritize it. They told us yes. We talked to the health department. So it was a very collaborative effort, and we had to have those calls on a pretty regular basis because health services can't make those decisions by ourselves. We have to make them with our partners. And we just had excellent cooperation. We called those folks, and within 24 hours, we had numerous phone calls back and forth, and it worked really well. Normally, like I said, we distribute a lot of vaccine, but flu's not one of them. This year was the exception to that rule. So toward the middle of the season, the Center for Disease Control decided that instead of just shipping the vaccine to who ordered it, which was what happened this year. So if you happen to have ordered everything from Chiron, you just didn't get any. If you happen to order it from Adventist, you got it. So that's when people said, well, why didn't my doctor get any when Fred Myers down the street got all they could use? It was because the one that got it ordered it from the one that had the vaccine. So in the middle of the season, the Center for Disease Control changed the logistics about how that happened and said that it had to be controlled by the state. Mm-hmm. So what we had to do then was take orders from the county health departments. They took them from their physicians. Then we sent them to the Center for Disease Control. The vaccine came to our office. We shipped it out. Then we had to bill the end user, which we normally don't get into, for all this vaccine. So it was an interesting effort.
It actually sounds like it is, because you essentially, the state preempted commerce on a flu vaccine, which is not normally life-threatening, but it is a good trial run as on what you would do if there was something that was normally life-threatening.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just a further comment. You know, I was at the other end of the supply line of this thing in our office. We happen to get ours from Aventis, thank you. Get lucky once in a while. But the program worked extremely well. We were constantly updated by this department of who the high-risk people were. We routinely turned down people who said, you can't have the vaccine. We have to hold it for our high-risk diabetics, our elderly. And it worked well. And the public got a consistent, straight message about who should get the vaccine, who shouldn't, which made it a lot easier for us at our office to give the vaccine to the right people. And we actually shared some of our vaccine with other people in our community because we happen to have a good supply in our office. We'd ordered a lot, but we gave that up to other groups. And then we worked with the county health department to move the vaccine also. So the program actually worked. The previous year, we ran out of vaccine, couldn't get the right people, but Costco was lining up people outside their shop there on Saturdays, giving it to anybody, and I couldn't get the right people. So it actually worked very, very well. You guys did a great job on this one.
Okay?
But I still want you to go back and look at why we had a shortage. It wasn't just a matter, I don't believe, of contaminated vaccine. We're dependent on supplies outside our country.
Exactly.
And we're held back in getting the supplies we need for some very specific reasons, things that we might be able to change at the state level. I mean, immunity from prosecution for vaccine. We know that a certain number of people get this vaccine or get Guillain-Barré disease or something of that nature. We know it's a very small percentage, and the public good that it does in saving lives is way in advance of that. But we need to look at those root causes, and I'd like to see you bring that back to us. I just got to...
Really, tort reform is not her area.
Huh?
Tort reform is not really her area.
We've had this... It actually is, to a certain degree. We've had the same problem with other immunizations. I think there's certain areas where you really have to give some relief to these companies, or you lose the public good.
Sounds like a Judiciary Commission, a committee issue. But we have one final comment from Representative Hansen.
It's always,
move on.
It's always great to have a committee with a doctor and a lawyer on it and give you a balanced view. Doug, what changed in the world that allowed there to be plenty of vaccine now? What was the change that eliminated the shortage?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's a very fine line that you walk. Everybody wants flu vaccine and you can't get it till a certain day, and it's almost always in early January. Then once that happens, it goes from everybody wants it to nobody wants it. So that's why it was necessary to go back and amend the plan so that we widened who was eligible for the vaccine. It's just incredible. Today, 50,000 want it, and tomorrow, nobody wants it.
So
and it's happened.
The amount of vaccine didn't change. It was the demand as you got later into the flu.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This office is responsible for 5 key performance measures, and unless we miss that, I've asked Lorraine to walk us through those. They begin... following that second white tab in the health services section, public health performance measures, so that you can follow this discussion with the text.
Okay, the first one is number 11, and it's on page 37.
Excuse me, the page 37 that Lorraine's referring to is in the overview section under the appendices. I think you remember from yesterday there's about a 75 or 80 page report in the appendices. We've also summarized those results in the health services section under the second white tab. So there's this one and there's this one.
Okay, great. So the one that I'm looking at is on page 36.
Wait a minute, you confused us.
There's several appendices under the health services tab, and so I'm trying to...
Mr. Chairman, the appendix that I'm referring to is under the first section of your book, okay, which is the overview of the department, the agency overview. If you turn to the appendix tab, which is the fourth tab, there is a lengthy document. Looks like has a, let's see, annual performance report. Can you hold it up?
Yeah.
A series of pages that look like this. Includes the references to the benchmarks. Yeah. I'm sorry this is so complicated, but I want you to have the information to look at.
I agree. I go to the, walk me through it again. I go to the yellow tab. It says
health services.
Health services. I go to the second, the third tab, which says appendices.
But it's it's under the agency summary appendix. That's
for all of the children, adults, and parents.
Pardon me.
The very beginning of the book. And page number again.
Okay. 37.
All right, thank you. We certainly want to be on the same page as you are.
Sorry, that was so complicated.
That's
too many pages. Okay, the first one is number 11, percentage of women subjected to domestic violence in the past year. This comes from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. It's for women that are 20 to 55, and it's self-reported, and because it's self-reported, we feel that it's underestimated. The most recent data that we have shows that we met the target. The target was 2.6, and we were at 1.3. The second measure is in regard to, let me find the page for you, page 47. This is number 16, the percentage of pregnancies that were unintended or terminated. This comes from the Oregon Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, better known as PRAMS. As you can see that we're actually going down, but we did not meet the target. The Healthy People 2010 objective is that we actually get down to 30%. You can see we have a long way to go for that. And nationally, we're about at 49.
Question?
Senator Montanison.
On unintended terminations, miscarriages, is there a differentiation between those that terminate and those that are unintended when they're reported? Or I know they're all lumped together here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think the intent was that we wanted to just do unintended pregnancies, but and were terminated was added onto that benchmark, and I think there's a move to change it so it just includes unintended pregnancies in the future, because it's hard to mix the two.
Yeah. They're right. Okay.
Well, there's a lot of unintended pregnancies that make for big families.
That's right.
So how do? You survey? Say, did you really want to have this baby?
Right. It's a survey of new moms, and it's, like I said, it's self-reported. And that, there's some questions.
After delivery or before? I mean, you know, there's different times.
It's a period of time, so it's probably over a several-month period. So. But it is self-reported, and that's where the data is kind of questionable.
Representative Hannah.
So what's the universal population that this question is asked to? All birthing mothers?
The PRAM survey that's referenced here uses birth certificate data, and they pick a random sample of new moms, and then they call those new moms, and they ask them a variety of questions. This is one of the questions they ask, but there's a number of other questions that they ask them.
I need to follow up. And then I guess I'm still not clear. What part of the 52.9% is somebody who said, whoops, got a baby on the way, and those that were terminated?
I think the reference to the terminated is about 5%.
So 53% of them have an unintended pregnancy, and of the 53, 5% are terminated.
Right.
Okay. Senator Winters.
Just a question. At what point in time does the survey occur? I mean, after, I'm thinking about afterbirth. 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, because that will really change one's response as to length of time as when, if you're asking was it intended, unintended, or whether you're happy, not happy.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I really don't know, but I'd be happy to find that out and get that information to you. I could do that.
Well, you know what? We're not going to let go of this one yet.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out why is it a performance measure of DHS to determine whether or not a woman intended to be pregnant or didn't intend to be pregnant? And what is the goal that DHS is going to do to help lessen the incidents where women is it going to be contraception, or is it going to be a, you know, I mean, what is the goal for DHS?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the one of the main interventions is obviously family planning services and encouraging women to seek family planning services.
I guess I share the puzzlement of the question. And, I mean, after the fact, do I go to Planned Parenthood?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can help out here a little.
Yeah, is this an abortion goal? That
oh, no, this is not an abortion goal.
No. What
the, our concern in the Office of Family Health is with low-income women of childbearing age and assuring that they have access to the services they need to make responsible decisions about their families.
Before they get pregnant or to terminate the
before
pregnancy?
Before they get pregnant.
Okay, it is also to terminate pregnancies. Is that what the goal is?
Well, there is a requirement in the federal...
Wait. Yeah. Let me finish my question. Is the goal beneath the surface that DHS wants to do is to assure that women who get pregnant that may not have intended on the pregnancy understand that the state will fund abortions for them?
Mr. Chairman, that issue will come up when we talk about the reimbursement with general funds for terminations of pregnancy. That's under the OMAP budget. What we're about in family health is making sure that not just women, but that Oregonians in the childbearing years have the option of getting pregnant or not getting pregnant, and that we provide them with access to that information. The federal law requires that full choice counseling be made available. That's a separate issue. What we have in this office is a waiver in the Medicaid program that allows women and men, actually, up to 185% of the federal poverty level to have access to family planning services. And as a result, pregnancies do not occur that in an untreated or in an environment where there was no access would likely occur. The estimate is that it's about 12,000 pregnancies a year. That has two effects. One is that women who don't get pregnant don't seek terminations of pregnancy. And secondly, that each pregnancy that comes to term and leads to delivery adds cost to the Medicaid program about $5,500. So from a cost-saving perspective, and this was Representative Hanna's question of yesterday, is that every dollar spent on family planning services saves about $5 in health care costs, and that's a fairly well-established quantification of those services. But the goal of the program is not to deliver abortions. That's not the business we're in.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
A second, Representative Hanna, and then Senator Montes Anderson.
If the goal is to get these services to low-income women, why are we measuring the entire universe of pregnancies? I mean,
that's a fair question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that answer, but I'd be glad to get it for you.
Okay. Senator Moss Anderson.
Also, I think it's important to note that when you have an unintended pregnancy, there are a lot of adverse behaviors that many women manifest, and one is not getting into prenatal care early, which we really want. That can another is many times there's an increased drug use. I'm trying to think of some others, but that's what we want. We want to make sure that the pregnant woman gets good health care, and when they're unintended, family planning services help that. And we want to avoid. We want to have a healthy outcome of the pregnancy.
Thank you for clarifying that,
given.
Sister Winters and Sister Bates.
I need to know what universe that you're surveying. You know, I hear the poverty, low income. Is it the total universe that is being?
That was the question, Representative Hanna, and she said she didn't.
And secondly, at what point is it after the birth? Is it where is it during gestation? I guess I just have a lot of questions when you say unintended. You know. I have four sons. I might not have planned to have any of them. I mean, you know, I mean,
and four girls.
I did want four girls. I mean, I did.
We won't continue this conversation.
But you see, I'm saying that unintended to me has it's vague enough to resonate a lot of questions.
Mr. Chairman, you and the committee deserve answers to these questions, and we'll provide a report on the PRAM survey and how it operates. But let me say that the interest in the public health area is in improving outcomes for kids and families. And I think Senator Mona Sanderson is right. It's not just about pregnancy. It's also about appropriate prenatal care and care following the birth of the child, and matters like encouraging breastfeeding and so forth, which have been established as public goods because of the effect on children. But I guess the question is what.
To be fair, that it is not covered by this performance measure. This is talking about unintended pregnancies and the issue of prenatal care, healthy start, early childhood, and all those. Those are kind of separate issues from the performance measure, but I do understand that they're all important.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I was referring to the PRAM survey, which Senator Winters was raising some questions about, which covers more than just this measure. This measure was established by the Progress Board as a key index as one of the chief outcomes we're seeking as a state, is to when a child is conceived and born, that child is wanted and receives the kind of appropriate care. And this is our contribution to that. We're not the sole responsible entity for it.
Senator Bates, and then we can move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. This may be more of a comment than a question, but there may be a question buried in it before we're through. This has always struck me as a very strange performance measure. I've watched it now for 4 or 5 years, and frankly, I think it's one that should be dropped, and that would be my suggestion. And the reason is multifactorial. One, I think the number you've got here for unintended pregnancies is probably actually quite low. Anecdotally, you know, after delivering a ton of babies, frankly, most of them were unintended, whether it came in a loving, wonderful family, and they're happy to have a child. There was many times they come and get tested, and they go, whoops, gee, what a surprise. And, well, that's great, we're going to have a baby now. And it has nothing to do with people being irresponsible or not wanting a baby or not loving a child. And so I think it's something you're not really wanting to measure. I think what you want to measure is there adequate attempts at contraception in the target group which we're concerned with, which is primarily people who are low income and who the state might be responsible for making sure they get good prenatal care, babies are healthy, and we do everything we can to make those babies wanted and loved. That's a different question, really. The result of that question is goes right to a huge moral dilemma in our country, one that splits our country, and that's abortion. And I don't think it's anybody who has a goal for increasing abortion in this country. We all have a goal of driving it down. Target would be zero, that we never have to do an abortion in this country, no matter how you feel about that issue. One of the ways of getting that is good contraceptive information to women so they can avoid that situation if they so desire.
What about men?
Men are hopeless. I heard that. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, but my point being, I think you need to change this. I think you need to drop this. It's just a lightning rod. It isn't getting the information you want. I think what you really want to look at is what percentage of men and women, okay, men and women, are getting contraceptive information. That I see as something the public should have an option of getting to, and that you have a responsibility of the state to present. But I would say that this is not getting that measured. And you may want to drop this and move into something that says, what are we really trying to do? Preventing unwanted pregnancies. That means contraception for most Americans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, and my comments somewhat coincide with that, but to bury terminated pregnancy measurement in this number seems unacceptable. And I don't know if it's up to you to make that number different or not, but the unintended pregnancy and terminated pregnancy to be combined like that just doesn't seem like a great measure of a real serious issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannah, we agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Next one.
Let's move on to one that I think that really expresses, I think, what Senator Bates was talking about.
Okay, the next one's on page 49. It's number 17. percentage of low-income women who receive prenatal care in the first 4 months of their pregnancy. We met this target. The target was 86.2, and we were up to 89.5. The national Healthy People 2010 objective is 90%, and the national average is 81.7 currently.
Okay.
The next performance measure is on page 63 for the Office of Family Health.
Targets.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Before we go further, and when will there be an updating of the targets since we're not at 100%? The targets have been placed previously, and now we've met it, and so we would like to, of course, be working toward a higher goal. When do you update?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Office of Family Health, as part of the Department of Human Services, has opportunities to do that, and we can look at that at the next window of opening to do that.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm always interested in why we're dealing with not current information from 2003. And in this day and age of computers and information age, why wouldn't we know how many women that gave birth in 2003 received prenatal care during the first 4 months?
Mr. Chair and committee members, sometimes this information is delayed in getting it, so you know we try to update this as soon as we can. You'll notice some of the measures we have 2003 data, and even on some we have 2004, but there's a few like this one where it really takes quite a while to get that information tallied.
Well, no, give us a better answer. I mean, it's been a year and a half. I mean, so can we try? Let's try something else. It's 14 months into it. Is 14 months not enough time to get a determination of something that took place in the year before last?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we would be happy to work as quickly as possible and hopefully get you the 2003 information in the next period of time, a couple of weeks, hopefully.
You think it might be available, but we just didn't get it?
This is the most current information we had available, but we can certainly pursue that avenue to see if we can get it for you.
It may be that this is more of a systemic question than a specific desire to, we've got to know this one issue.
Yeah. Okay, I'm much more concerned about the flow of the information rather than, obviously, the information we've got is showing good, steady increments of progress that I wouldn't be surprised that in 03 that there was a dramatic change. But I just always wonder why there's such a lag time on some of our measurements.
Just ask a quick question. On this particular performance measure on lag time, are you trying to measure the prenatal care for babies born in 04? Because you won't get the information on 03 till they're born in 04. There's a 9-month lapse of time here. And you're looking at the first trimester of pregnancy. And then you got to get the information from the hospital, probably to the county, I'm expecting.
Yes, that's true.
When those prenatal, when the baby's delivered, we mark down whether they got prenatal care, where they entered the system at. You won't know that information till the baby's born. Then it has to go, I expect, to the county. And then if every county reports, and you think they don't want to report, possibly?
No, it just takes time for the county then to report.
And the county has to get the information, and then you have to put the information together. So you got a 9-month lag if you're looking at deliveries in 04, 403.
Yes, that's accurate.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have to get everything in of all the babies that delivered the first 9 months of 04 from the counties put together, and then you get the 03 figures, and this is the first part of 05. That's probably the delay in this particular.
So the information is not obtained until the birth, and then at the delivery they're asked if they had prenatal care.
The forms you use in the hospital for delivery, and many of the women just walk in labor. I've never had any prenatal care, and so we have to get all that information from the hospital brought together.
Well, that would,
and they have to report to the county, and they may report to you on an annual basis. They may just give you a report for all of 04, for all I know. That gives you information for 03.
We get it more often than
then
that.
It rolls forward. So I think this is sort of a special one where.
Once again, the experience on this side of this committee.
So I got you on the hook on that one.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, just to reinforce what you said earlier, is that there are systemic components that make it difficult to get. We would like to have data as close to real time as possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we can't because our systems, that is to say our technology, is technology from the 70s that computers are old, and that the legislature has done a lot to move us forward in that area. We're improving them rapidly, and some of you may remember we're talking about a unified family data system for early childhood and all of these services. So I think we will see improvement here, but there are also systemic barriers to getting data more quickly. I'll try to get more information about the answer to that question for you.
Okay, final question, then we'll move on.
Well, thank you.
Well, if they're born here, I mean, they can see.
How old do you really think anyone is? What's your oldest computer? I mean, I walk around this building and these facilities, and I don't see very many old computers. I see a lot of new computers. Now, I think we have some old operating systems or some old collection data, but I think it would be unfair to the public and us to say that there's a bunch of old computers here.
Is that a question?
Mr. Chairman. It's a question. How old do you have the old computer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I'm not a technology specialist, but it's really not the personal computers that are the issue. It's the software that we're using to collect information and bring it forward. And that, I think, is the subject of the Joint Committee on...
I think we do.
IT. John Britton can help me with this management information. And there are changes in the works that will create a central data processing system for the state. I think there's a lot of excitement about improvement in our systems, but it's really not the computer that sits on my desk that's the issue. It's the one that's putting huge amounts of data before us so that we can use it, manipulate it, and ask it questions.
I understand that, but let's be careful when we say it's old computers, because you got people listening and watching, and if they come to the building and their perception is completely different from that, then we're driving a wedge between reality and what's happening. If we have old operating systems, or if we haven't upgraded our technology to the point that they link together between the information you're collecting from providers and that kind of thing, let's say that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll be more careful. I think there will be an opportunity for the department's chief information officer to tell you what the department is doing, and he understands this issue much better than we do.
Okay, the next measure is on page 63.
No.
This is measure number 22, percentage of 19 to 35-month-olds who are adequately immunized. This is a measure that's not a national measure. This is a measure we're using in Oregon. And the reason we chose this measure is because the children that go to local health departments are more often not the ones who have a medical home. So this is the one that we have a harder time to influence in increasing immunization rates in children that go to local health departments. We did meet the target. The national work that's done around and just for your reference, it's always been quite amazing to me that CDC calls 2-year-olds 19 to 35-month-olds, but that's how they define 2-year-olds. And when the national folks look at the immunization levels for 2-year-olds, they look at basically 4 DTP, 3 polio, 1 MMR, and they look at it for all public and private together. So if we're considering not just the local health department, but all the public and private immunizations together in Oregon, we're really at about 80%. And I think most of you know that most immunizations in Oregon are given in the private sector, a very high percentage, 85% moving up toward 90%. The U.S. average is a little bit higher at 82.2%. The next one is on page 65. This is measure 23. It is the percentage of adults age 65 and over who receive an annual influenza vaccination. We didn't meet the target. The target was 75.5, and we're at 70.5. The national 2010 objective is 90%. No state is anywhere near this, and there's been a lot of work by the Association of Immunization Program Managers to see if CDC would change that, but they haven't done that so far. It's still at 90%. The national average is 69.9, and Oregon is ranked 22 in the number of states for flu and vaccination.
Mr. Chair?
Okay.
There's a move to encourage individuals to get pneumonia vaccines, are you going to add that as a performance measure as well?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have additional measures in addition to these key performance ones, and one of the ones we report on regularly is the pneumococcal one. Actually, Oregon is second in the United States for having a very high rate for pneumococcal vaccination. So it's one we track, but it just doesn't happen to be a key performance measure.
Could you clarify one thing? As we're looking at the graph, and we see that in 2006, the target rates go down. Is there a reason that you could explain for us why that's the case?
I think, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is sort of like one of the discussions we had a little while ago. When you look at the chart, you see that the targets are totally off. Once a year or so, we have the opportunity to adjust those targets, and that's what happened here.
But you didn't adjust it until 06.
Right.
But still left the inappropriate target for 05.
Yeah, right.
Okay, we'll just move on.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how much time we have this morning, so cut me off if you need to. Okay. You kind of blew past the 19 to 35-year-old, 30-month-year-old kids not getting immunizations, and you blew by it so fast.
Sure.
I was still reading it as you went through it.
Okay.
Of the many things that public health does, vaccination on a cost basis is probably the best, along with clean water. We saw a little bump in this in 2002, 2003, but then we're kind of leveling out here. What are your barriers still to getting this number up? I mean, the target's only 70%. The target should be 95%, frankly.
Mr. Chair, in
many countries it is 95%. Our country lags far behind anybody else. Is the barrier still cost, or the barrier still the difficulty of getting these children into public health facilities to get the shots? I mean, many families cannot afford these injections, but public health is available to them, but they may not know. Give me a feel for what's keeping us from moving up further now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think most of you know that there's a program called the Vaccine for Children program that provides free vaccine to Medicaid-eligible folks and folks with no insurance and Alaska Native and American Indian. So that program is available in the local health department and in private physicians' offices. In addition, in local health departments, we make vaccine available just about to anybody except for fully insured folks. So in most cases, getting immunizations in the local health department is not a barrier. The exception to that rule currently is pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, which we still have a two-tiered system for, but all other vaccines are readily available in the local health department. I think some of the barriers that continue to plague us is that these aren't always the same children. There's a lot of rotation of who's included in a health department population that they serve. They go to the private physician when they have a job, and then when they lose their job, they go back to the public health department. Then they might go to a different public health department. And I think also the one that kills us on immunization rates is forced DTP. If you look at all other immunizations, we do pretty well on. But if you look at forced DTP, we don't do well on that one. So that's one of the things that we're trying to focus on in the next 2 years, is to encourage that children get that forced DTP on time.
Can I ask a question? Just interrupt you. DPT is diphtheria,
tetanus, and pertussis. Sorry, I
didn't find that. What is the incident in our society of children in America or in Oregon getting diphtheria or pertussin or tetanus?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the diphtheria and the tetanus part, we rarely see cases of those because since the vaccine has been introduced, we're like at 98-90% that we don't see those kind of diseases. But pertussis...
Is it like vaccinating for polio?
No.
In other words, that which may have been crucial 20 years ago, is it still necessary to continue to mix vaccines and do that today in the same way it was in the past?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all it takes is one international traveler coming from a country where they might have diphtheria, which still does occur, and that's why they have diphtheria still in the vaccine. The critical piece for this vaccine right now is pertussis. And I think you know that we've been having an outbreak of pertussis for the last several years, and the numbers keep going up, up, up. So that's really critical for us, that we get that full series of pertussis into children, primarily to protect them against pertussis. The other problem that we have with pertussis is that if you look at the incidence of the disease, you'll notice that some of it occurs in young children, but there's also quite a bit in adolescents. And it appears that we have some waning immunity, and they're working on a new vaccine that we can give to adolescents and adults that they're hoping that will be introduced in mid-2005.
Okay.
Just to give you some further information, We had an outbreak of diphtheria about 10 years ago in an Indian tribe across the border in Washington State because we didn't immunize that group well. That's a deadly disease for children. We just don't see it anymore because we have diphtheria. But it's still in the world. We have not eliminated it. We almost did polio and we did smallpox. Tetanus is in the soil around us at all times. And we do occasionally still have tetanus deaths. They're rare. Mm-hmm. Usually it's elderly people who are not immunized. So you still have to immunize against tetanus all the time. Pertussis, whooping cough, is a different story. And there's a vaccine available that does not include pertussis because there were so many reactions, and some of them quite serious reactions to pertussis, the vaccine. We got a better vaccine out about 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
5 years ago. But now we're a little concerned that might not give complete immunity, and so we're working on refining that even further. We've had an outbreak of pertussis in our part of the woods, as you know. It's treatable. It's quite serious as far as adolescents are concerned, but it's really serious for the very young. You know, 2 and 3 year old children, it can lead to, rarely can lead to death, and it can, but it can lead because of high fevers and effects of the disease. It can lead to brain damage and other serious problems. So it's still worth doing. We're going to have to continue to do it, unfortunately. My concerns about this whole program goes back to why are our numbers so low, and you really haven't answered that question, but I'll talk to you about it privately. I've got some ideas what needs to change.
Okay? Thank you.
Okay, it is 9:30.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
And this is important information. You're controlling your time, so shall we move on, or how would you like to spend the next hour?
I think we're ready to move on. I just wanted to point out that the exhibit that's on the screen...
Appreciate the information.
...addresses the school-based health centers program, and the turquoise-colored counties are counties that already have SBHCs, school-based health centers. We have three counties that are in the planning phase, and that's Deschutes, Jefferson, and Coos. The governor has proposed adding 5 counties, and when we come back in March, we'll be talking with you about that policy option package that the governor has brought forward.
Yeah, we do.
Our next segment, and I appreciate I think you can see from this discussion that we have a lot of issues in public health that are worth exploring further.
Okay, before we go any further, John Britton.
Barry, just to clarify, the subcommittee was given a final report of the governor's racial and ethnic health task force report.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and this is the report to which Mr. Mason was referring yesterday.
That's correct.
Okay.
This report was issued long before Dr. Mason joined our executive team, but he is now responsible for the implementation of its recommendations, and we're managing to those results. The next section of our presentation, we shift now to mental health and addictions, and joining me will be Bob Nickel, who's the administrator of our Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services.
Good morning.
You want to switch places? Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and I'm going to switch chairs.
When you get there.
Thank you. The approach that I would like to take would be to give you a brief general description of what the mental health and addiction system does, and then move as quickly as possible to talking about key performance measures and outcomes. Now, with the fairly broad set of responsibilities in mental health and addictions, which ranges from alcohol and drug prevention to substance abuse treatment to the state hospitals, to community mental health programs, to gambling addiction treatment, we actually have only 3 key performance measures. But as I go through each of these areas, I will start off with those and then talk about a few others that I think would be of interest. So that will be my plan, and so be happy to move right into describing generally what the mental health and addiction systems do. First, I just want to mention that generally we provide prevention services to all Oregonians as well as to certain targeted groups that are particularly at risk, especially children and adolescents. We provide treatment for addictions and mental health problems to more than 116,000 adults and 35,600 children, and that was for calendar year 2004, which is the most recent data that we have. For addictions problems in particular, the services that we support are assessment, detoxification, individual, group, and family outpatient services, residential treatment, and increasingly aftercare and alcohol and drug-free housing. We served in calendar year 2003 53,000 adults, 6,300 youth, and 550 older adults. For gambling addiction problems, the services include a hotline for referrals, assessment, crisis intervention, outpatient, and some limited residential treatment. And for your reference, these materials show in your overview section for Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services starting on page 5. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that to begin with.
Which page 5?
Page 5 in the overview tab. I believe that's the first tab after Phase 1, OMAS overview and priorities. Okay. If continuing on page 7, you'll see for mental health problems, the services include 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis services, pre-commitment investigation services, and I'll go into that a little bit later, case management, outpatient counseling, medications, day treatment for children and adults, residential treatment for all ages, acute psychiatric hospitalization, which is done almost entirely now in our general hospitals and psychiatric units around the state, except for Eastern Oregon, where we still do acute psychiatric care in the state hospital. We also provide what we call extended care and state hospitalization. Extended care refers to, by the end of this biennium, about 800 placements that we will have created over the last 12 to 15 years that are really alternatives to having people in long-term care in the state hospital. These are usually Medicaid reimbursable services. They are almost always less costly in terms of the daily cost, and then with the Medicaid funding, they're an even better deal financially. And we if I refer to the extended care system, that's what I'm talking about. And then the state hospital itself.
A question is, what's the criteria for determining whether a person can be in one of those 800 beds that would have previously been in the state facility and those that still must be in the state facility?
Mr. Chair, we have a unit within the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services that was set up in, I believe, 1994 by the Emergency Board, which is the gatekeeping body that it makes those decisions. Those are clinically based decisions based on the needs of the patients who are ready for discharge and then doing the best fit to the community extended care project.
When you say ready for discharge, discharge from what?
From the state hospital, Chair. In other words, we have the staff go into the state hospital, work with the state hospital social workers and the doctors, and identify those patients who are ready for discharge, who cannot actually be discharged to lesser community levels of care. And many patients are discharged directly from the state hospital into regular community care, but there's a subset of patients that have higher intensity needs, and that's what the extended care management unit does, helps make those decisions.
Okay. During the course of your presentation, you'll be going into detail about state hospital populations and so forth.
Mr. Chair, I'll be doing that, yes. Now, in the community mental health system, for calendar year 2004, we served 60,000 adults, 20,000 children and adolescents in the community. And then in the state hospitals, we served 1,495 adults and 57 children. And again, this is for calendar year 2004. So you can see that although 25% of the state budget is in the state hospital, it serves a relatively very small number of people, relatively speaking.
You said, I guess I just need to have it clarified, that you're looking for 800 new beds that would be filled with those who previously would have been in state facilities. And then am I hearing that now the total number in the state facilities is 1,400 adults?
Mr. Chair, the 800 beds or placements that are in the community, yes, are those beds that we've created over about 12 to 15 years. The target for discharges I'm sorry, for admissions to those extended care projects are patients in the state hospital.
So how many, what's the population presently, and what would be the population after the transition utilizing the additional beds?
Mr. Chair, I probably should back up and explain a little bit. The 800 beds began to be developed when we were in the process of closing Damage State Hospital. We actually started the process sooner. So these are beds that have been out there for some time. And if you want to think of it this way, it's really kind of like satellite programs that help the state hospital manage its population and also places for people to go who have fairly high-level needs and aren't ready for a discharge back to outpatient care. So the 800 beds are beds that we have developed and used over a period of time. They're not new. We're not new beds that we're proposing in this budget.
Is that number static, or is there any increase that's taking place in the next biennium that you'd anticipate?
Mr. Chair, that number is not static. We've been gradually increasing from about 250 in about 1994-95 to this 800 number. So each biennium we've been creating additional beds to serve people who would otherwise have to be in the state hospital.
Okay, and in the next biennium, will the increase be increasing or remaining flat for the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, I anticipate that we will continue to develop more of these extended care projects in the 05-07 budget, depending on what the legislature approves. But my anticipation is that we will need to continue to develop them if we're to manage a state hospital population of the current size that
and
we have.
I guess my question is not just kind of an intention thing. Are there firm plans where you're asking for funding so that there can be X number of additional community-based beds for those that are in the state institutions that might transition to them?
Well, Mr. Chair, until we actually have the budget, we can't actually put a request for proposals out. But we've done this biennium after biennium, so we have kind of a process that's already in ready to go, and we will implement that kind of a process, assuming we have the budget.
Okay. Now, I'm following up because this is about budgets. And so what I'm hearing you say is if we get the money that we would like generally, then we will use part of it for this, but we don't really have a specific earmark program for doing this out of the money that we're requesting.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the best way to answer that is that we have a factor built into the base budget called caseload growth, and it applies to both civilly committed patients as well as criminally committed. So in the base budget, there is money that we normally identify that would be the pot of money that we would either have to add more state hospital capacity or we could develop these community programs. So that's the equation that we'll get into as we move further along in this process.
Is there any intention of expanding the state hospital capacity?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a perennial question. Right now, we have...
I feel like you're dancing with me, but I'll keep at it if you want to.
Mr. Chair, right now, we have about 54 patients over our budgeted capacity in the state hospital. So the question is, do we, as a policy, increase the wards, the number of wards at the state hospital, which, as that aging structure continues to deteriorate, costs more and more in terms of startup money, or do we develop more community programs? My own belief is that we can develop more community projects, and that's a more cost-effective way of doing that.
Okay. So are you saying we have 54 overpopulation, and we are desiring and attempting to expand the community-based placement opportunities so that we can get down to a zero overpopulation, or that we are going to continue to consider expanding our facilities at the state hospital, because those are different funding issues?
Mr. Chair, I think the longstanding policy has been to try to develop as many community programs and try not to develop any more state hospital wards.
Okay, that's the longstanding policy. I'm asking about your specific policy. In the next 2 years, is it your goal to expand beds in community-based capacity so that we can lower these 54 beds? In other words, are you shooting for 54, for 10? What is the specific goal as far as institutionalized patients versus those that would be in the communities?
Mr. Chair, my goal would be to create the community placements rather than add more state hospital capacity. One of the reasons for that is many of the patients at the state hospital are ready for discharge now, and the estimates vary from time to time, but I think it's reasonable to assume that there are at least 50 to 100 patients right now who are ready for discharge, and we haven't been able to create fast enough the community resources that could allow us to discharge them. We've created a record number of those community placements this biennium, but the inflow, and I'll get into that a little bit later, has been so great that we cannot keep up with what the number of patients are that are coming in the front door, in spite of creating record numbers of community placements.
Okay. Would you take just a minute and tell us about the record number of community placements? How many is that record number in the current biennium?
Mr. Chair, I can get that number for you. I want to make sure that's the most current number. But my memory is that we have created about 45 additional community placements for forensic patients this biennium, but another 45 to 50 are online, and like I say, I will get the exact numbers for you. And in the civil area, we've also created, I think, about the same number, 50 to 60 community placements for civilly committed patients, and we have online another, I'm told, about 100 to 125, but I will get those exact numbers for you because we do track those carefully.
And there's a reason why I'm doing this, and that is that we're about priority. And this sounds like a fairly high priority, mm-hmm. and yet, as we're going into the conversation, it's passive voice and general ideas and not a specific budget item that we want to have X amount of dollars of our budget to generate another 100 beds or another 54 or another 50 and 45 so that we can have another record-breaking biennium. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for the specifics because that seems like that'd be a high priority in your area where there may be other things that would not be as high. And so rather than a general kind of amorphous budget for your section, ultimately we're going to be trying to set up some priorities, and we just like to have help.
Well, Mr. Chair, just off the top of my head, I think we'll probably need to try to create at least another 250 to 300 of these community beds if we're going to be able to keep up with the state hospital population. But again, I can go back and get more exact projections on that for you.
Mr. Chair, question. How much of the discussion that we're having about community expansion and development of community beds in the state hospital is involved in the master plan that you're working on, that where you receive the approval from and the funding from the, I believe it was the November Emergency Board, to address these particular issues? And when will you have that report completed so that that can help this body?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's a very good question. In fact, one of the, first of all, the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan Phase 1 contract, we hope that we can announce the signing of a contract later this week or early next week. We're actively negotiating with the winner of the request for proposal process. That will then allow us to begin working immediately with the goal of having a Phase 1 report to the legislature on May 15th. The reason that's a very good question is that one of the things that we need to look at is what is the optimum function and size of a state hospital. If it's the current 750 beds, then that will mean one thing in terms of the community placements we would need to create. If we were to try to operate a smaller hospital system of, say, 500 beds, we would have to create that many more community placements.
Isn't it also important that the information that's going into the document includes the involvement and the role of corrections, as well as what's happening with you in the state hospital and forensic? I'm saying this because there's this linkage between corrections as well as the state hospital, forensics, and all of it has to begin to come together for the long-term, long-range planning.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's exactly right, and we have been having active discussions with the Department of Corrections about what a shared facility might look like, what their needs are, what our possibilities are, and that is indeed a key part of the master plan process.
And the other part of that is the judicial system and their role, as well as the role of the review board and how. So there's multiple pieces that's involved in the long-range plan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that's correct.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I might like to suggest how we might proceed here. There's another piece that the good senator has not mentioned, and that is treatment of alcohol and drug, which you're also responsible for, which weaves this whole thing together. It might be best if we heard your whole presentation and potentially held our questions, because you may answer a lot of them as you go along, and those that you don't answer, we can ask at the end of the presentation. It might save us some time to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'd be happy to move through the presentation. I did want to talk about the alcohol and drug issues next. One of the ways in which these are linked, too, is that we estimate that about 70% of the state hospital patients have alcohol and drug problems. They may not all be classically addicted but they, you know, it's an issue that needs to be attended to if we're going to successfully treat them and then discharge them into the community in a safe kind of way. However, many alcohol and drug-involved people have no mental illness or mental disorder, and I want to be careful not to imply that all mentally ill people have alcohol and drug problems, and nor do all alcohol and drug-involved people have emotional disorders. It's a very important distinction to make. But where they do overlap, we need to be about providing integrated treatment.
Can you tell us what percentage are dual diagnosed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, in the community, we generally believe that about 40 to 50% of people who come in the alcohol and drug programs have some diagnosable emotional disorder. And in the mental health area, about 50% or more of people who come in for mental health treatment have alcohol and drug problems. Having said that, with some certain subpopulations, for example, hospitalized patients seem to consistently, in Oregon and around the country, have this 70% rate of mental health, or I'm sorry, alcohol and drug issues. And in other subpopulations, for example, in the population of people with mental illnesses who get involved with the criminal justice system, there are studies that indicate that as many as 90% of those people with mental illnesses who are in the criminal justice system have an alcohol and drug problem. Among homeless mentally ill people, that number of 90% plus is also pretty accurate. So you can see that among the more troubled, challenging populations of people we serve, it's much more common than not to have both problems. In the alcohol and drug prevention area, and this is on the bottom of page one, in underneath the performance measures and outcomes tab, you'll see that we have one key performance measure. It's number 19, and it's the percentage of eighth graders at risk for alcohol and other drug use. And this is linked to the Oregon benchmark number 49, teen substance abuse. The bottom line here, I think, for the committee's attention is that the current level of student use in Oregon is higher than the targeted level. And in fact, compared to the national average, Oregon's eighth graders are using alcohol and other drugs more than other eighth graders around the country on average. I think that's of serious concern to all of us. This is a benchmark for the kind of difficulties that our young people are going to experience as they go beyond the eighth grade. And there's particular concern that eighth grade girls are beginning to show an increase in drinking patterns. So not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I'm sure it would be natural to ask, what are we doing about that? And while we can't absolutely control all of these kind of things, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is moving to more aggressively address this problem through evidence-based approaches, gaining consensus among local and state stakeholders, and we're calling an underage drinking summit. I think it's going to be held in May of 2005. And we need to work more closely with alcohol retailers and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So there are a number of things that we have in the works that we will be doing to try to address this issue. Another, it's not a key performance measure, but another benchmark that I would like to call the committee's attention to has to do with methamphetamine use among Oregon's adolescents. And again, this is also higher than national average, and that's a great concern. For example, the 30-day use of methamphetamines by eighth graders increased by 18.2% between 2001 and 2004. And again, I believe this is on page one of the phase two detailed budget section. I don't want to get us too far ahead, but there is a reference to this later in the document if you want to look at it.
I mentioned that last Saturday I spent the morning in Grants Pass with Greg Walden and contingency of experts from the federal government dealing with a meth summit, and they were talking about the huge increase among young adolescent girls in meth use and how serious it is. It's getting down to the fifth and sixth grade level, a tough situation where parents are giving meth to their own kids. I mean, it is absolutely amazing how bad situations become.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's a growing concern among all of us, whether we're working in the administration of things or people like yourselves. And I appreciate the interest that's there.
Bob, Mr. Chair, you don't need to bring it back right now, but just looking at your alcohol and drug treatment outcomes, if you can add a couple categories to that, I think it would be helpful. For example, the length of time that the individual is in treatment on average would, and also, you have here, and I made a question mark about what happens after treatment, because you talked about no arrest during treatment, but there isn't the category of whether their after treatment has occurred. Just kind of fill those blanks in just a little bit. And my other question, because I don't want to lose it before we, is when you go to the methamphetamine abuse issue, and when I looked at the chart, we were doing 22,186 in 02, and down as far as the care involved, the episodes, 18,741. Why?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I believe you're referring to this chart that you have in your materials. What explains that is that the cuts that we were required to make last biennium really did limit access to outpatient care for people of no matter what their primary drug of abuse was. So what we saw there was a drop-off not only in access for people with methamphetamine issues, but a drop-off in access for people with alcohol and other problems. What you see with the green, I don't know if you have it in color in your chart there, but on the overhead, okay, it shows in green. We did not take cuts in services to the youth, so we've actually seen a slight increase over time in the access or episodes of care involving meth abuse for young people.
Let me see if I follow this. We have, in 02, we actually were caring for over 22,000, and in 03, we dropped to 18,741, and our problem is going up, not going down.
Chair, Senator Winters, that's an accurate statement of what's happening. Finally, I would just like to call your attention to the fact that Oregon also has one of the highest rates of use of marijuana in the country for people, young people ages 18 to 25. So when we think about our prevention efforts, these are some of the benchmarks that we need to be gearing our efforts to in the next year or two and into the foreseeable future, I'm afraid. Moving on to talking about alcohol and drug treatment, we've jumped ahead a little bit here, but let me just go back and talk about the key performance measure number 18, which is percentage of, and again, this is on the top of page 1, back in the performance measures and outcomes tab. Sorry to jump around a little bit here, but the key performance measure, again, is the percentage of engaged clients who complete alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and are not abusing alcohol or other drugs. The 2003 target was 54.4%, and the performance was slightly better at 55.7%. However, there are many other key performance measures, and the chart that we've had up here for the last couple of minutes shows alcohol and drug treatment outcomes for 2003. I appreciate the suggestion for adding some additional categories there. I know that we can get the information on length of time in treatment, and we'll look at the other suggestion that Senator Winters made, too, and see if we can get that in here. But for our purposes this morning, you can see that 94% of alcohol and drug clients were engaged in treatment. What that means, concretely, is that they came back for a second appointment. This is it may seem trivial, and it's certainly not the only benchmark that we have. You can see we have, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 others. But it is absolutely critical that people come back a second time. If they show up one time, we're pretty certain that that's not going to result in much benefit to people. I mean, there are stories of people who go to treatment one time and that does it, but that's, frankly, pretty unusual.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monsenerson.
When you say 94%, how many, is this in the hundreds? How many people, raw numbers, do we have? Or thousands? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, I believe this would relate back to the approximately 60,000 people. So this is a very large number of people who come back for their second appointment. The second bar, second bar here shows received appropriate treatment. And this is an evaluation that's based on the addiction levels. We call it ASAM for short. It's a nationally recognized level of care determination process, and it's built into our administrative rules. Every time we review an alcohol and drug program, this is what we look at to see whether they're making the decisions that fit this nationally recognized way of sorting people into the right care. And so we have here an 87% appropriate treatment level when we do a detailed review of the patient's needs, or the client's needs, I should say. 64% are retained in treatment. Retained in treatment is defined as 90 days of treatment or more. The literature shows that if you can keep someone in treatment for 90 days or more, the odds of success go up dramatically. So that's why the 90-day retention and treatment standard was created. Completed treatment is a little bit lower, 60%. I think that probably compares pretty well to most national averages. I could go back and look and see if I could find some comparative data, but I think that that's generally what people have assumed would be a reasonably good figure. 71% reduced usage. You would probably logically ask, how do you determine this? The answer is that this is something that the counselor at the end of treatment, when they fill out the termination form and provide us with the data, give us their best estimate of whether the person reduced their usage. We use a combination of client report, family report, clinician judgment, and occasionally urinalysis. Actually, occasional is not accurate when it comes to people who are coming to us referred for DUII, driving under the influence, and other criminal kinds of things. The use of urinalysis with that population is much, much higher. 64% of people are employed after their treatment. 44% of families regain custody of their children. 83% have no arrests during treatment, and 83% show, and these are for kids for the most part, improved school behavior.
Sure. Just a moment, please. Mr. Britton.
Bob, in terms of testing people for urinalysis after they've received treatment or during treatment, what are the rules, or do you do that a lot? Do you not do it very much? Or what are the rules around that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Britton, I can go back and get you more detail about this, but information about this. But generally speaking, if people come to us through the criminal court system, they're going to have a very high regular use of urinalysis. If people come to us on a voluntary basis, we don't have the mandate necessarily to do it as frequently. I'm seeing studies now that are just coming to our attention that suggest that the more we do urinalysis, probably the better the outcomes are. Now, that may be more a function of the criminal court involvement, and we'll have to go in here and tease the research apart a little bit more, but I do think that we need to look at that issue as we do on a regular basis.
Mr. Chair, Bob, could you provide us with the number of what percentage of these come through us through the courts and what percentage are voluntary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we will have to go back and get that information, but we were talking about that earlier during the earlier presentation, and we can get that for you and bring that back. I'm sorry I don't have it off the top of my head.
And it would be helpful to know the percentage that come to us through the court where you have this legal sanction and you have some abilities to do the thou shalt, what the success rate are of those versus those that come in voluntarily?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, there are studies that I'm aware of that show that the success rate is actually a little bit better if people come in on a mandated basis. But that it's a matter of degree. It's not that people can't come in on a voluntary basis and get good help for the problems and overcome them. In some sense, as a former alcohol and drug counselor, I can tell you that hardly anybody comes in just out of the clear blue. Most people are under pressure from families, if not our courts or employers. So in some sense, there's almost always some stick that's hanging over the person's head, if you will.
Just one note from this meth summit that I was at on Saturday. They indicated that the treatment for meth can be successful, but only 40% of those that go through treatment stay off of meth, and 60% don't make it, even though they've gone through the full treatment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to that, I don't know how strongly meth differs from other addiction patterns. My guess is it's different, but not a lot different. Sometimes people have to go through treatments a lot of times or several times before it's successful. And one of the studies I saw a few years back that said in terms of other lifestyle diseases, like diabetes, where you need to change people's lifestyle in order to be able to successfully control the disease, it's about the same percentages of people that have to go through a couple times before they get the right right behavioral patterns for their disease. So if we've got a 60-40 split, 40% success first time through, 60% that go back to using the drug, there may be, by the time people have channeled through maybe two or three times, you're talking about really changing the number of people using the drug. And it sounds frustrating that, you know, that we have to go to the time and the effort and expense to go through it two or three times, but sometimes that's what it takes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if I could just comment, I think that's exactly the kind of question we're asking now. Do we need more of a continuing care model and think about treating people over a, you know, over a period of years? Not that they need to be in intense treatment during that whole time, but we probably need to think differently about just a, you know, a single discrete episode as being adequate for all people, at least. Some people do that, but I think we have to think about it as more of a chronic or continuing care disease model, if you will. All right, let me move on. Just in terms of benchmarking where we've been at in terms of people receiving access to any substance abuse services, you can see from this chart and that we've increased gradually from 1999 up until about 2002, and then because of the cuts, you can see the kind of decline that we're looking at that's occurred for adults. And then for kids, you can see that we've protected kids in terms of protecting the services, and we have not wanted to make cuts there. So you can see that we have a pretty steady line there. I think the logical question to ask is that keeping up? And I think given the other data that we've already talked about, the answer is probably no. This is just another graph showing people receiving outpatient substance abuse services. This is both kids and adults, and you can see here we peaked at about 50, a little over 58,000 people receiving services in 2001, a little decline in 2002, and a pretty dramatic decline of about 6,000 people fewer getting substance abuse outpatient care in 2003. That's the most recent year for which we have complete data. Moving on, looking again at the chart that we showed a little bit earlier, total episodes of care involving methamphetamine abuse. Obviously, we've been climbing in the numbers of people who had that as their primary drug of abuse until the cuts in 2003, and we lost about 3,500 at that point. Kids continue to incline gradually, but again, it begs the question whether that's enough. Moving on to, unless there are other questions about substance abuse treatment, I'd like to move on now to mental health. And I just want to make a few introductory...
One moment. Senator Westland. Bob, just with regard, this is a general question, and maybe if you go back to the first slide, it's best to use that in terms of illustrating the question. Your first bar, 94% engaged in treatment, and maybe that bleeds over to the 87% received appropriate treatment. In what time frame? I mean, the question is, are we getting these folks into treatment soon enough? And I don't need an answer today, just sometime at a more convenient time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, I do know there are waiting lists, and we'll see what we can do. It's difficult when you have people on waiting lists because they're not actually enrolled yet. So, but we can see how close we can get to an answer.
Right. Though, are we losing while they're, you know, they're waiting? And how big a part of the problem is that? Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'll continue on. I want to just make an introductory remark about state hospitals. From 1862, when Oregon first contracted for its first, what we would now call a state hospital, it was called the Oregon Asylum for the Insane in 1862. It was operated by Dr. J.C. Hawthorne up in Portland. And Hawthorne Avenue is named for Dr. Hawthorne, as I understand it. But he began the first psychiatric institution in Oregon. And for almost 100 years, that really, in essence, except for a few child guidance clinics, that was the mental health system. So everything that we've seen created since the late 50s and early 60s in the way of a community program, we have to understand that's actually a relatively new, you know, 40-year phenomenon. Another point to remember is that, generally speaking, and this gets back to some of the earlier questions we were addressing, Mr. Chair, the shift from institutions to community-based care is also something that's been going on for some time. What we're showing you here, and I believe this is in there is a chart along this line, and again, I'm leaping ahead a little bit. It's in the Phase 2, page 7 section. If you want to look at that, but this is the same chart. What we're showing is the increase in acute care, which is the top line, and these are generally admissions that happen in community hospitals to psychiatric units.
This is hospital only, right?
This is hospital only. Mm-hmm. That's correct. So, in other words, in Medford, this would be Rogue Valley Hospital. And they have something like a 22-23-bed psychiatric unit. It admits both private pay as well as public pay patients. Oregon is, I think, one of the states that has said that it doesn't matter what your income is, you get the same quality psychiatric inpatient care whether you're rich or poor, you're insured or not. And these hospitals around the state have these kind of psychiatric units. So you can see that we increased access from the mid-3,000s up to a peak of a little over 6,000 in 2002, and it dropped down a little bit in 2003. I think the reason for that is that there were some hospitals that closed in the Portland area. The stories which we have all heard about Pacific Gateway and Woodland Park, those hospitals, although there were questions about the quality of care, they did provide a capacity, and I think in my looking at this, that would explain that drop from over 6,000, actually almost 7,000 admissions in 2002 to 2003. The number of people served in state hospitals, as you can see, has declined from a little over 2,000 in 1994 down to the number that I gave you earlier, probably around 1,500. And then the bottom line on the graph shows the gradual increase, and again, this speaks to the questions that came up before. Have we been increasing the extended care projects over time? And you can see that indeed we have, from 1994 of probably under 300 to the current close to 800 in 2003. That gives you, I think, a quick overview of the development of the most expensive levels of care, from acute care to state hospital to extended care.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
I'm a real big fan of community-based housing for our mentally ill, and I know that there is an incidence going on in Gresham where the neighbors have decided they didn't want to have a particular resident house some people, or an institution. I think it's ARAD. I can't remember. Anyway, the question I have is, what kind of PR are we doing with the cities? Because we have neighborhood groups, and we have the cities who have an attitude, not in my neighborhood, when they don't understand that mentally people with mental illness, as long as they are managed and take their medication, can be very productive citizens in our society. So I'm just wondering, what type of PR can we do, or are we doing, with our cities when they designate whether one of these housing units can occur in a particular neighborhood?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, I think there's more we could do in working with cities on that. So I think that's something we're talking about, frankly, within our office, how we could do more of that. I don't have immediate concrete things right now, although I think being in closer touch with cities, I think what's happened is, since the statute requires us to work with counties, I think more of a focus, frankly, has been on working with counties. And I think the issue of working with cities around planning and zoning, I think those are things that we could do a better job of. On the other hand, I would also, want to point out that there are many cities and counties that have worked very collaboratively with us on developing these kinds of projects. And, I think one of the things that's a principle, it seems like, in mental health work, is that when things work, they don't seem to get as much press time, they don't seem to get as much attention. And I think the fact that we've quietly developed 800 beds of a system that many people have never even heard of says something about it actually works well enough that it's not in the press. And I think we need to do a better job, though, of advertising, in a sense, the successes that we've been able to have with these kind of projects. We have, for example, 6 or 7 other locked, secure facilities around the state. They're in various parts of the state. There's some in southern Oregon. There's several in the Portland area. There's 1 or 2 in Lane County. And yet I think people aren't very aware that they're out there, but they are, and they're working well, in my opinion. I hope that answers at least part of the question.
We need work.
Just want to mention the governor's proposed budget contains $400,000 for further study on more community-placed beds and then $4.3 million to actually provide additional beds. So, I mean, who knows how that all ends up, but it's certainly on his screen.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
the good senator does raise an interesting question, because so often when we talk about community facilities, and whether we're talking about the mental health or developmental disabled when close Fairview, that there is this issue out there in communities of not in my neighborhood kind of thing, and I think there are
NIMBY, NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, not in my backyard, in my neighborhood, the same thing. But and so I think that not only the responsibility of maybe the agency, but I also think the responsibility of the legislative body as well to educate the community, because I mean we're the one that sets the policy, and so I think it's a collective effort. I don't think that it's just one entity. That we all should have a stake in this particular issue. Mm-hmm. And thank you, good senator, for raising it.
Thank you. Okay, we have a few minutes left. Yeah. Let's continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next overhead that I wanted to show you is what's happening in forensic services. This is a graph that takes us back to 1996, and you can see it's pretty self-explanatory. This is what's driving a lot of the census issues that we have at Oregon State Hospital and the forensic unit. Today, as I mentioned before, we're, I believe, we're 56 forensic patients over our budgeted capacity. And just to help you understand a little bit about what's driving this, the adjudications of people who are found guilty except for insanity to the Psychiatric Security Review Board hit an all-time high for calendar year 2004. That was 126 adjudications. Now, when you think about the criminal justice system in total, it's a very small number. But when you think about the previous high was 110 in 2003, and the previous high before that was about 90 the year before, and the previous high before that was in the 70s range. What we have is a dramatic increase in the number of people who are found guilty except for insanity by the court systems. This is not something that our state hospital has any control over. We admit them when the court tells us that we're to admit them. These people are often people who are going to be with us for a year or two or three. So it's not like in acute care where you have an average length of stay of 9 days. You can absorb some of these kind of increases, but this is a very huge challenge for us. And again, in spite of developing a record number of specialized community-enhanced care placements for forensic patients leaving the hospital, we're not able to keep up with the number of patients who are coming in the front door. I should add, I think the language here needs some amplification. These are not just clients on this graph that are adjudicated guilty except for sanity, but there's also about 100 of these people right now who are people who are being treated until they're able to aid and assist in their own defense. So most of this growth is driven by the Psychiatric Security Review Board adjudications, but just remember that about a quarter of those people come in, and it's also in a criminal court commitment, but in a little different category.
Mr. Chair, Bob, is this the population that creates most of the violent issue that was in the paper recently, where a staff is being injured and what have you? Is it coming from the forensic population or in general?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, it tends to be on the forensics units. Now, the people who are on the civil commitment units often have psychiatric disorders that are indistinguishable, but the difference is that they haven't committed a crime. They've been placed there under a civil order. And frankly, with the forensic units being so overcrowded, And they're overcrowded also because we are under state and federal court orders to accept people within 7 days. On the civil commitment side, we don't have that same court order driving people. So what's happening there is we've been able to cap the census. And so those wards are somewhat more manageable just because they're not over the funded capacity like the forensic units are. In order to deal with the forensic problem, I will tell you, though, that we've been trying, when we can do it safely, is transfer some forensic patients over to the civil side. The problem that that creates, though, is that patients who are waiting to get into the civil commitment beds of the state hospital stay in our local general hospitals longer than they should. And so it's clogging up the capacity in the local acute care hospitals like Rogue Valley and Good Samaritan in Corvallis and the Caremark hospitals in the Portland area. So we're trying to manage the census the best we can, but it creates problems in other parts of the system. The next overhead shows you really getting at the heart of the issues that we began the discussion about. The projected census at the state hospital is going to be going up this biennium. Looking in the middle of the chart there about 2005, you can see we're already the number over that I mentioned. And if we do nothing, in other words, if we don't create enough community resources, this problem will get more and more difficult to manage. The alternative, as we talked about before, is to add more state hospital wards. But I think the policy that we ought to strive for is to create community placements for those people who are ready to be discharged. And I believe that those patients are there. On the parallel side for civil commitment caseload projection, you can see that we've had a fairly steep climb there, and I'm pleased to see that the climb that's projected is not as steep a climb, and I think that's in part due to the increase in the community, assertive community services that we've seen, the increase in things like the SageView project in Bend, which is just now getting up and started, but there are crisis triage centers that are getting developed around the state, which are not hospital level of care, but try to intervene before people have to go all the way to a hospital, and I think that helps us keep some control on the state hospital population of civilly committed patients as well as the acute care admissions. I should tell you, too, that the actual rate of civil commitment is going down rather than up. So although the numbers are stable at about 1,000 people civilly committed each year, it's not growing as fast as population. And I think that's in no small part a tribute to the hard work that community mental health programs do with people who come to their attention. I think the final overhead that I wanted to show you just quickly here is a chart going back 10 years showing the number of people receiving any mental health services. It's divided up by adults, which is the top line, and children, which is the bottom line. The growth in children really took place in the mid-80s when there was a lawsuit. So you don't see the steep increase in numbers of kids who came into the community mental health system at that time. It's since then leveled off somewhat. The increase in adults receiving mental health services primarily attributable, in my opinion, to the Oregon Health Plan. And then the drop that you see has to do with the loss of the standard benefit package for mental health, and then the decrease in number of eligibles for the OHP standards. Moving on, talking for a few minutes yet about the state hospital. Other performance measures that we look at on a continual basis are a whole series of measures that the quality assurance teams within the hospital look at. And I'll just tell you about a couple of them. The seclusion restraint rates, which is considered to be one of the key markers of whether you're operating a humane state hospital. And in spite of the overcrowding issues, I'm pleased to tell you that we're below the national average in the rate at which we seclude and restrain patients. I think that's, again, a tribute to the staff who are working hard over there in pretty difficult circumstances. All of the other data that's tracked on a national level, I can get you more detail on this if you'd like, is also below the national average. So our state hospitals, in spite of the stress that they're under, are under all of the national standards except for a couple, and those have to do with privacy issues. The patients are crowded, particularly on forensics, as we've talked, and they say so when we poll them. We ask them, do you feel that you have enough privacy? Do you feel that, you know, that part of your treatment is well attended to? They are concerned about that. So that's a challenge for us.
Bob, a question,
Steve
Mr.
Winter.
Chair. Because I had a meeting not too long ago with a substantial number of the employees, and although, you know, those stats are looking good, are our statistics on the safety of our own staff and does the workers' comp claims, are they going up? And I'd like to see those statistics and compare those, because you have two challenges while you're making certain that you're doing the standards on restraints. But if it's at the risk of our employees that are being injured and hurt, that poses some other problems. So I'd like to see what those statistics show, because they were very concerned. And when I asked the question, how many of them had been hurt? I think everyone in that room, I had must have had almost 50 people, their hands went up. And then when I asked the question, how many of it more than once, you know, and so that causes me great concerns. It must make certain that our staff also are being safe.
It's really difficult because, yeah, you know, being in a criminal element, I mean, working in a prison is tough. Working in a criminal element with mentally, you know, affected persons make it even more so. And I know some people that that's their career, and it's very, very dangerous for them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we'll get that data for you. I do understand that the numbers of reported staff injuries have been increasing, and we will get that data for you so you can look at it. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to point out that state hospitals treated and released 900 patients. Now, we served more than that, but some patients didn't get out this past year, obviously. But I think it's important for all of us to recognize that 900 patients were discharged in 2004. This means that there was a lot of hard work put into a discharge plan. A community had to accept them. And so I think that we need to lay that out as one of the benchmarks, is that we discharge 900 patients. This, from an economic standpoint, we discharge people then from the most expensive level of care. State hospitals, as you may or may not know, require almost entirely state general fund because of federal prohibitions against using Medicaid dollars in state hospitals. So when we discharge people from state hospitals to lesser levels of care, about half of the forensic patients are Medicaid eligible, so we can take advantage of Medicaid in the community for those people. But even those people who are not Medicaid eligible are not going to that high a level of care once they leave the hospital. So all of the discharges are actually very good things to have happen, not only for the patient, but also financially for the state.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The people under the psychiatric review board, are they eligible for any for Medicaid benefits, or are they considered incarcerated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, while any patient, whether they're under the forensic or psychiatric security review board or civilly committed, if they're in a state hospital, they are not eligible for Medicaid. So once they get out, then we can take advantage of Medicaid for those patients who are Medicaid eligible. And as I said, about half of the forensic patients are considered disabled enough that they qualify for Medicaid.
Are you having any problems in terms of getting your people eligible for Social Security benefits after they come out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I think that's a perpetual issue for staff. Now, I think the state hospital does this on a routine basis, and I think they, frankly, have gotten very good at getting people eligible for disability who need to be that. And they also, because particularly in forensics, have people for long enough, you know, months and years, they have the time to work through the appeals process if that's necessary. In the community, I think that's a perpetual challenge to have case managers and doctors well-trained so that they can work that process efficiently.
Would you have information for us? Now, this is an ongoing thing in our corrections arena. Would you have solid information for us in terms of how it works to get people pre-qualified while they're still in while they're still in custody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, I have a staff person who's working on those kind of issues. And, I mean, the bottom line, and I'll try to get some data on this for you, but the bottom line is that because corrections has so many other things that they need to do, they don't have the kind of specialty social workers in psychiatry that we have in the state hospitals. So I think, you know, almost by definition, they struggle with it more than the state hospital does. They also have workloads, caseloads that are much higher than the social workers at the state hospitals. So I think corrections is at a disadvantage in doing this as efficiently, and that's an issue that we need to be talking about.
Thank you.
Okay, wrap up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the last thing in the state hospital section really has, again, to do with the extended care system. These are people who would otherwise be in state hospitals. And I did some checking to see how many people between 2000 and 2004 we were actually able to move to lesser levels of care from extended care projects, which are the most intensive levels of care in the community that we have, to lesser levels of care. And the answer that I got was that we moved at least 664 adults to lower levels of care. The significance of this is that if we don't move people from the extended care projects into lesser levels of care, there aren't as many places for state hospital patients to be discharged to. So the fact that we've been able to move hundreds of patients to lesser levels of care is a good thing. And I think the fact that you don't read about this in the newspaper says that for the most part, it works really well.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to thank you for the handout that you gave, and just as a general housekeeping matter, it would help us, since we're working with a loose leaf, if the handouts come punched, and also like the one that we got from Human Services, it would help if this one isn't this way. The one you gave us, we could actually go like this, but as you see, now we got a problem because we're spinning our books back and forth, and so it would actually be helpful if we could have it set up so that we could put it in our binder and actually see it during the presentation. And the one that you provided today, that was it was easy to do that, and so we appreciate the handout and the valuable information.
But Mr. Chair, yes. It would be nice to know then where we should put these. Is there a tab that we're supposed to put these in? Sometimes they're labeled as to where they go in our book, and other times they aren't.
HAS is coming here, right?
Mm-hmm. Use my imagination.
If you have under your yellow tab for health services, the second blue tab is phase one OMHAS, and so, you know, I put mine right behind that blue tab, but just because that's...
Thank you. Moving.
Thank you very much. We're almost out here.
I just want to say, even on these, it's hard because, like, this one is out of sequence as well. I mean, it goes like 28, 26. The pages are out of sequence. So when you're telling us that, we're flipping different directions to get to a page number. Just
coordinate with.
We can do it, but it takes a little time, and you hear us up here shuffling because it's not in page sequence.
Fair enough. We'll try to do that.
Housekeeping, but it does help. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman, today.
Village. Yeah.